hear the appellant's argument.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Steve Lowe, and I represent the United States, the appellant, in this appeal. Section 922H does not require proof of the payment of wages or of other tangible compensation. Such a narrow interpretation of that statute limits the plain meaning of the terms, it's contrary to the intent and purpose of the statute, and it further opens the loophole that Congress intended to close when it enacted the statute. When we look at the plain meaning of the terms employed for and in the course of employment, it's a broad term. Employed does not exclusively mean payment of wages. And in the court, in the case that this court brought to our attention, the Murphy case, the court had to interpret the terms employed to assist in a case where there was an assault on a local jailer and was charged with assault under the federal statute.
Let me stop you right there. Before you get into the merits of this case, I'm a little nervous about the procedural posture of this case. This is an issue that's coming up on appeal regarding the sufficiency of the evidence to prove a charge before there's been a trial. What is the best case you've got that we have jurisdiction over this type of case in the posture that it's in?
Your Honor, in the district court's opinion, it went through a number of cases, and I can cite those for you. And the way it got in this posture was based on the court's ruling regarding what the United States had to prove. We had entered into plea agreements with some of the parties, and at the plea hearing, which was after the court's ruling, the United States conceded that we had absolutely no evidence of payment of wages or payment of other form of tangible compensation. So based on the court's ruling, we conceded that we couldn't prove the case under that narrow interpretation. And the court dismissed the charges based on our concession. So we have a final ruling from the district court dismissing the charges in the indictment. So
based on a conceded lack of evidence.
Exactly.
You may be right. I'm just nervous about it. You can go on to the merits if you want to. I just want you to give you an opportunity to address it.
Well, I appreciate that. And the purpose of that is, why waste the time of going to trial when we know what the result is going to be?
I see the practical value of it. I'm just worried about the fact that it's an unusual procedure for us to have this issue presented.
I understand, and I appreciate that, and I've never encountered that before either. Typically the facts get played out before the jury, but in a case like this,
you even put on your case?
We did not.
I mean, would you? If we decide we don't have jurisdiction.
That's an interesting. If you decided that you didn't have jurisdiction,
we decided it was interlocutory in some way,
and remanded the case, then we would put on our case.
You couldn't. The judge dismissed it.
Exactly.
We'd have to vacate the dismissal order.
Right. If the order of the district court dismissing the charges was vacated and remanded because you decided you didn't have jurisdiction, then we would put on our case, but then we get in a tricky issue at Rule 29.
Rule 29 dismissed.
Exactly. And whether jeopardy has attached at that point, and that could be based on what the judge bases its ruling for the Rule 29 order on. But under the strict, narrow interpretation of those terms, there's no doubt that we would be dismissed at Rule 29. Rather than wasting that, and I think the judge said, rather than exalting form over substance, let's get a decision from the Court of Appeals on this issue of what it means for someone to be employed and to possess a firearm in the course of such employment. And it's a broad term.
If there was a Rule 29 dismissal, would jeopardy attach?
It very likely would. but it would depend on how the judge fashions its order dismissing the case. If it's insufficient evidence, then Rule 29 would double jeopardy would attach, and we would not be able to
appeal. But it wouldn't be on it, the argument you would obviously make at that point is that it wasn't on the lack of evidence. It was on the misconstruction of the statute.
Right.
Because you would argue you offered all the evidence to satisfy the statute without showing compensation.
Exactly, but then that would raise an additional issue on appeal, which is whether jeopardy had attached or not. So in the Murphy case, this court had to interpret the terms employed to assist. And the court held that employ has a broad meaning. It's an expansive term, and it has multiple meanings. And the multiple meanings do not make the term ambiguous. It can mean to make use of, to engage the services of. And that's exactly what we have here. It can also mean paying wages, but not exclusively mean paying wages.
I'm going to interrupt you again. I'm sorry. I just want to ask you one more question going back to this. Ben, is there any process by which a defendant can come up here and challenge a legal issue, decision made by a district judge, without either having gone to trial or entered a plea of guilty? I mean, could a defendant do this? You know, the judge says, well, I'm not going to suppress this search. I think as a matter of law, this search is legal. Can a defendant come up here, straight up here, without having pled guilty or gone to trial and raise this issue before us?
Well, it's interesting because the kind of analogous procedure would be if the judge summarily issued a conviction prior to trial without...
Well, presume it's the legal decisions made on a stipulated set of facts. I mean, are you getting to do something? My point is, are you getting to do something and go through a process and a procedure and get up here and get a decision in a way that defendants are not permitted to do? And it may be, maybe they can. That's why I'm asking.
Well,
what's the appeal statute say? There isn't a statute that says the government can appeal a bunch of orders that the defendant can. And I thought one of them is dismissing count.
But there is a
motion to suppress is also one where the government gets to appeal. But I don't think the defendant does. I may be wrong, but I thought there's a statute.
No, I think you're right. And it is based on the statute. And those are two different statutes, and the one is, the based on a motion to suppress, and we have to assert certain things in our
you don't know what
motion.
You don't have that.
I don't have that statute.
Go ahead,
but
I'm sorry.
That is interesting.
Some in substance of your view is that it's the dismissal of the charges that provides the basis for an appealable order.
Sure, Your Honor. I mean, the judge issued an order dismissing the counts in the indictment, and we're appealing that order dismissing these counts because of the narrow interpretation of the term employee. The Congress could have said a formal or salaried employee. They could have said an employee hired for wages, but they didn't. And that's the exact issue that the Supreme Court addressed in the Community for Creative Nonviolence versus Reed. They had to interpret the Copyright Act and the term employee, which was not defined in the Copyright Act. And the court specifically rejected the argument that it meant a salaried employee or a formal employee because the statute didn't say that. The statute just said employee. So instead, the court looked to the common law agency principle, the master-servant relationship, which is what we're asking the court to do here. The master-servant relationship is exactly what we have under the facts of our case, and it makes perfect sense in interpreting the term.
Well, the payment or non-payment of wages would have some bearing on it, would it not?
Certainly would, Your Honor. And if we had evidence of that, we would put it on to prove employed for. Payment of wages is evidence of that. But our point is it's not the exclusive means, and that's what the judge ruled.
Well, what other means should be taken into account? I mean, what other factors? You agree that the payment of wages is a factor. What other factors would you?
The most important factor, and the one that keeps coming up in these cases, in the Supreme Court cases in agency, is control. What control does the principal have over the agent in that is it employing the agent to do things for the principal? And that's what we have here, and we agree with the concept of agency. The the boss, the crime boss, is the principal who's employing his agents to be his armed security guards because he's a felon. And that's how you limit the meaning of the terms employed, employed for, and in the course of the employment. Because the term is unambiguous and has a plain meaning that doesn't get an absurd result, we don't need to go to legislative history. But if you do go to the legislative history, it clearly supports the exact scenario that we have here factually and the interpretation for a broad term, interpretation.
Just in the course of this case, I know you stipulated this away, and I wonder whether that was wise. You've alleged that this gang obtained extorted monies, rents and payments, and presumably distributed among gang members, or the gang leader paid for lunches or whatever they did as they traveled around. Aren't those facts that would support some form of compensation?
Your Honor, that would, and nationwide, that is an activity that the pagans engage in. But in this case in particular, the extortion that we had in this case was kind of ultra-virus. It was outside of the gang. It was a gang. It was the same gang leader who was getting involved in extortion on the outside, and it didn't involve the armed security guards. So really, in this case, it's different than many RICO cases, and we don't have...
This man is indicted for possessing a gun while in the employ of the leader. It doesn't matter what the leader was doing. It seems to me it's an ongoing relationship in which he's sharing in the proceeds of extorted money. He's getting compensation. He's being paid lunches, or his gas is being paid, or these gangs travel around. And the fact that this particular conduct, it serves his role. It's a goon for the mafia head. This is what the Congress wanted to get.
I agree. I 100% agree with you. And I wish we had that. We don't have that evidence in this case.
Well,
we don't have the evidence that...
You alleged it, didn't you, in the indictment?
Not in this count and not for these defendants. These defendants were carrying guns as armed security guards because their boss told them to. They did not get compensated. They did not get an extra share of the drugs. They did not get to, you know, extort better businesses as you would typically have. If we had that, wouldn't be here today. But as the Judge Niemeyer, as you pointed out, that is what the statute was enacted. It was enacted to get at the mob bosses who get trigger men to do their dirty work.
Well, I thought that the defense posed an interesting question in their brief. If we accept your construction of the statute and the meaning of the word employ, one of the questions they posed was, let's suppose I'm a convicted felon, and I've got a rabid fox in my backyard, and I ask my neighbor, to come over and shoot it because I can't carry a gun. If I've accepted your definition of employee, am I not guilty of violating the statute by getting you to come over and use your gun for purpose of mine?
It's a much more fact-based inquiry than that simple example, because when you get to the agency principles, if that's all the facts, then do you as the principal
use a gun on my behalf?
Right. So do you have any control over me? Are you going to tell me where to go, where to shoot it, how many shots, what kind of gun? I mean, there's more facts that need to be explored at a trial, if there were to be a trial, to show that the principal had some type of control over the actions of the agent. And if you don't have that control, then there's not the master-servant relationship that would make someone liable for the acts of an agent. In that scenario, if that's all there is, I don't think that the person who does the shooting is the agent of the convicted felon. If he's simply doing him a favor, the felon has no control over the neighbor. He's just his buddy, and he's doing him a favor. And that would not make him an agent.
When you say control, are you talking about control over their general work or control over the instruction or the obedience required to use the gun?
Both. I mean, the control, again, is very fact-based, and the courts look to, in the community for creative nonviolence case, they looked at control over, you know, the actual artistic integrity of the work of art. I see that my time is up.
I'm looking at the indictment, and it says, the purposes of the enterprise include the following: enriching the members and associates of the enterprise through, among other things, extortion, robbery, and the operation of illegal gambling business. And then it goes on to talk about the role of the various people, and the defendant in this case is a bodyguard for the leader. And it seems to me that if you can prove that the purpose of the enterprise was to enrich the members and associates of the enterprise, not just in this case, but generally, or any acts of the enterprise through extortion, robbery, and the operation of illegal gambling, this guy got money somehow. And he said he was loyal to the boss and would do whatever he commanded. But they eat, they drink, they have gas.
I 100% agree with you, and there are examples.
What about the allegation in the indictment? You couldn't prove that?
Well, what we would prove, and a defendant was convicted on an extortion count, but the extortion was the gang leader, who's the convicted felon, he's the national vice president, who engaged with someone else to extort someone totally unrelated to the gang. And for these specific defendants in our bodyguard conspiracy, we do not have evidence that they, particularly, as bodyguards, were compensated for being bodyguards. We have evidence of, interesting, a lot of the agency cases talk about whether someone is an employee for workers' comp. Well, the Pagans have their own kind of workers' comp because the president of the Pagans will put money on their commissary accounts when they're in prison. So join the Pagans. If you go to prison, we'll give you a little workers' comp for being in an outlaw motorcycle gang, and we'll put money on your commissary. But we don't have evidence that these defendants in the bodyguard count were compensated. So in conclusion, we would ask that the court...
I don't know if they have to be compensated. They have to be in the employ at the time they possess the gun. And this is not a time-laden... you don't punch a clock if you're a member of a gang. Well, you conceded it, and so that you tried to place the clear question whether you can be in the employment, in the course of employment, without receiving any compensation.
Yes, Your Honor, and we ask that the court reverse the district court's dismissal of the 922H counts because employee does not exclusively mean payment of compensation.
Okay, thank you. Ms. Purdy?
May it please the court, my name is Deirdre Purdy, and I represent the appellees in this case. The government could not have reached the conclusion that it reached about the meaning of this statute without violating a number of principles of statutory construction and interpretation. The first and maybe most fundamental is this is a criminal statute, and we should strictly construe criminal statutes to avoid extending criminal liability beyond that intended by Congress.
Can I ask you a question?
Please.
If Congress said employed, comma, with or without compensation, comma, would you be Would this be a different case?
If they said employed with or without compensation and left out the phrase in the course of employment.
Oh, they left that in. Comma, with or without compensation, comma, and in the course of the employment, possessed a gun.
No, sir. It would be a different case. Obviously, it would be a different case.
And would the
case.
Government be successful in that case?
Not necessarily.
Why?
The government would not necessarily succeed because these gentlemen were not employed in any sense of the word. At least all of them were not. And so
goes to a question of what employee without compensation means.
It does, exactly.
And if you go to employee without compensation and just go to the, you can go to the restatement or whatever.
Sure.
That's another issue. The question of whether compensation is necessary, you would say would be avoided if Congress said with or without.
Definitely, clearly.
So that, if you agree with that, then it seems to me you have to acknowledge the word employee can support employee without compensation.
In a different statute,
the statute
that you're writing.
With or without.
Yes.
Well, if it does, then it's not, it's within the class of meanings to have employment mean both with or without compensation.
I agree, and in fact, as the Murphy case made very clear, employee has a multitude of meanings.
Why do we construe this one limited, or why do we restrict it in the fashion that you say, which it means it's limited to with compensation, when the term is broader than that and Congress used the broader term?
The first reason is because we do have the course of employment in this statute.
Well, I understand, but if employment can occur without compensation, that's irrelevant. In other words, that's another term. The possession has to be within the course of the employment. But if we can have employment without compensation, there's a possibility for that term to mean that. Then the question is, why should we restrict Congress?
Well, I don't believe that we can have course of employment.
Why?
Without. Because course of employment is a term of art that has been used for more than 170 years. It has 58 uses in the United States Code. And every one of those 58 uses has exactly the same meaning.
When I looked at the, was reading the Murphy decision.
Yes, sir.
And this is a direct quote from the court noted, quote, that the term, and admittedly wasn't the same statute, but Murphy says the court noted, quote, that, quote, the term employee has a broad sweep and is expansively used. Employee means to make use of, to use advantageously, to use or engage the services of, to provide with a job that pays wages or a salary, as well as to devote or direct a particular activity or person, citing Webster's dictionary. But in Murphy, there's no statement that says employee has to be limited to the one fact of compensation, or that compensation is a sine qua non.
No, sir, there's not, and that's because the use of employee in Murphy was employee to assist. And one of the common uses of employee, as the district court pointed out, is to employ for a purpose.
But when Murphy's talking about the term employee.
Yes, sir, he's talking about the term employee.
Just that term. I've never understood this to be a single factor litmus test, but rather a multi-factor test. If Congress had wanted to make it a single factor test, they might have used the word hire, or they might have used the word compensation. But neither the word hire or the word compensation or the word wages or appear in the statute. There's no monetary term in the statute. There's no reference to money in the statute. And we would have to read, wouldn't we have to read a monetary term into the statute? And if we read a monetary term into the statute, a monetary transaction into the statute, wouldn't we be narrowing the scope of the statute in a way that Congress declined to do?
Judge Wilkinson, the district court's at holding was that this statute required an employer and employee relationship in order to impose criminal liability. The district court then went on.
Which means a compensation.
And then went on to say, and that implies compensation.
But that's not in the, to me, this was there's a straightforward point here, which is that Congress didn't use any word that directly means compensation. There's no reference to money. There's no reference to hiring, to wages.
Yes, sir, but they use the term course of employment. The government has adopted, as you'll see in their reply brief at 3, the government has adopted the term of the definition of course of employment that the court and the defendants have offered. And that definition is things that happen during events or circumstances, part of one's employment, especially the time during which an employee furthers an employer's goals through employer mandated directives.
Well, that doesn't advance your cause. That compensation is necessary.
Well,
if you think in terms of the leader of a gang wanting to isolate himself, he's a felon, he wants to isolate himself from the use of firearms, so he has his lieutenant hire these thugs to be bodyguards. Well, they're not really thugs because they don't have a record. They're allowed to have guns. But they're in the service of the gang leader. And if they possess a gun while in the service, while in the course of employment, in the service of the gang leader, the statute will criminalize that. But the question still remains, and I don't think the words in the course of the employment add anything other than the possession of the gun has to be during that relationship. But the question still is, does that relationship require compensation? And that's a difficult question. My real question to you is, if it has a broader meaning and can include with or without compensation, then you'd have to answer, why didn't Congress limit it to with compensation?
If I may point out first that the definition of course of employment that we've all adopted includes the word employee. The word employee does not have more than one meaning. That is, we can't say Jane used John to get back at her boyfriend. We wouldn't say John was her employee. Employee has a specific use.
The statement seems to say you can be an employee or servant without compensation.
If we left compensation or tangible compensation out of it, let me point out where we end up, and this is one of the points in our brief, that if you open it up to the larger definition of use, you end up criminalizing the acts of my client. My client had his carry permit for years before he ever joined the Pagans. He had his firearm for years before he ever joined the Pagans. And
is there some safeguard against that in the term, to that person's individual's knowledge? In other words, the innocent carrying of a gun with a carry permit would never be criminalized. You have to have knowledge that the person that you are working for and whose directions you're taking is a felon.
Yes, sir, and indeed my client knew that Floyd Moore was a felon, and Floyd Moore...
Even more, he'd have to be in the service of the gang leader.
And Floyd Moore asked him...
And in the control. I mean, the other safeguards that Judge Wilkinson was asking about, the other attributes like control, seems to be would be central to an employment.
And Floyd Moore asked him, and Floyd Moore was the national vice president. There was a hierarchical organization. Floyd Moore asked him to bring his weapon to a meeting, and he brought his weapon to a meeting. There was no shootout. There was no bodyguard. He simply used him for what...
It may be as a factual matter, you could show that his carrying of a gun wasn't in the course of the employment, albeit without compensation, and that he was not in the service. When he carried the gun, he was not in the service of the leader. But that's a factual question. The only thing before us is whether we construe employ and course of employment to require an element of compensation.
I would ask that the court, this court, notice that the district court's holding was that it requires an employer-employee relationship.
That doesn't answer the question because if employment does include employment without compensation, then an employment-employer relationship doesn't answer the question. You can have that relationship with or without compensation.
I understand your point, Your Honor.
One of the things, Ms. Purdy, that I wanted to ask you about was this provision, this statutory provision, isn't just dropped in willy-nilly into the U.S. Code. It's 922H, and it follows directly upon 922G. So I think it's fair to assume that there's probably some interrelationship between 922G and 922H. And what about the point that the whole purpose of 922H following immediately upon 922G is to prevent artful avoidance and circumvention of prohibitions in 922G. You can just see Congress saying to itself, if we can ascribe to it a collective thought, look, we've put all these provisions and all these prohibitions into 922G, but look, there can be loopholes here and ways around it and ways to evade and ways to circumvent. And we better close that down and not allow to be done indirectly what we've just finished saying can't be done directly. So in trying to interpret the statute, one of the number of things you look at is, well, why does Congress have this here? Why is it placed in this fashion? Why is it here as opposed to somewhere else? And isn't that the reason?
I have no doubt, Your Honor. And in fact, as you're probably aware from the briefing, at one point the 922G was 1202A and 922H was 1202B.
I didn't know that.
And in fact, so when they rewrote it and expanded the number of prohibited persons, then they put H in a separate place. So I think that interpretation of the placement of it is precisely correct. But the
H also explicitly refers to G, doesn't it?
And it defines a prohibited person, which we're using as a shorthand for anyone in 922G. So I think that's correct, but the question and the concern is, in framing that statute, although in the statutory history they refer to gangs and the mafia and so forth, the statute says nothing about gangs and the mafia and bad people. It says prohibited persons, who interestingly are a much larger group, in fact, or I don't know by numbers, but by definition, a much larger group than gang members or and so forth, and that those are the persons who cannot employ, and in fact the history shows us that Senator Long said employ, he said hire, he said have as employees. So if we want to look at gang members in the statutory history, we also have to look at the number of times that he said hire and employ. And have his employees and be employers. All those terms were used in Senator Long explaining what the point was. I notice I'm running out of time, but I would like very much to go back to certain facts that you picked up on, Judge Niemeyer, out of the government's brief. This thing about my client, Mr. Weaver, saying that Floyd Moore was his boss and he would follow him anywhere. That's not in evidence. The place that statement appears is that the U.S. Attorney, Assistant U.S. Attorney, read it at a hearing. It was never presented. The proponent, the alleged taper, never appeared. We never...
Well, let me ask you this. I think that's a point well taken. And it's, I think, regardless with how we construe this, we can't get into the facts. We've not had a trial. And what we could say, it seems to me, on a very limited basis, whether a boy requires some level of compensation or exchange of value. That should end it, it would seem, one way or the other, because whether this man actually fits that criterion, you have a lot of other questions of whether there was control, whether he possessed it in the context of the gang or some other reason. And you said he had a permit, he was law-abiding, and this type of thing. So I think that's a point well taken.
That's for the jury, isn't it? Because I don't know, you know, even if we were to say that compensation is not a sine qua non, I have no idea of knowing whether or not the government can prove control or an agency relationship at trial. I mean, I haven't examined the facts of the case. But a lot of these questions would be for a jury as to whether they can actually prove that sort of control. Maybe they can, maybe they can't. I can't forecast that at this point.
Yes, and their basic evidence that they turn to is a hierarchical structure and the facts that Floyd Moore once said that he didn't have to carry a gun because other people carried them for them. So it would certainly be a question for the jury whether or not these individuals who are charged
You would be perfectly free, it seems to me, to argue that these individuals possessed a certain degree of autonomy and that they were free to come and go as they pleased and that, you know, they were not under strict control. It was an intermittent thing. They had other jobs. Didn't this person have another job?
Yes. Oh, yes, sir. In fact, job that he lost because he was indicted.
Okay. But, I mean, but before the indictment, he had another job.
Yes, he did.
If I were you and putting on that case, I would say, look, there's none of the control. He had another job. He did that. There's no evidence he left it. But I guess the point I'm saying is I can't forecast the evidence, and I can see the kind of things the government would argue, but I can also say as a defense attorney that I would have a good shot. I think we're really right here to this narrow question as whether compensation or wages is a absolute precondition of is an absolute requirement under the statute. And, you know, as I've indicated, my basic concern about the position is that there's no direct monetary language.
I see my time is running out, but something that greatly concerns me in the lines of questioning that you've taken here today is, if we leave out monetary compensation, what do we mean by employ? And my concern...
Well, the Supreme Court's addressed that. You know, this is not going to be an easy case to resolve. The Supreme Court has said in the context of employment statutes, the FSLA, that type of thing, that employment does have a compensatory aspect to it. But in other contexts, it has said, in distinguishing independent contractors and employees, it has not said. It said, look to the common law. Congress didn't define it. And when you look to the common law, I think pretty clearly the relationship of being in the service of an employer does not require compensation, but it does require control. And that really is at the heart also of the independent contractor employee dilemma. And hospitals have that problem with respect to doctors. Is he on the payroll? Do we withhold taxes? This type of thing. And it goes to the control. So I don't think we're going to find it easy to get an easy answer to this. It seems to me it might have to be contextual. But if we go to the common law, it looks to me like the worries that you have would be satisfied by the criteria of when a person is a servant of a master. He's in the control and the service and in the course of would be during that. And that, I think, affords a lot of protection.
And so if you suggest that it would be a master-servant agency relationship, broaden it to that degree, but avoid broadening it in the way that the government has suggested to mean any use or any tasking.
That use of the word employ and use seems to me that's a different meaning altogether. That's not the person in a relationship. But a person in an employment relationship, I'm suggesting might, and I don't know the answer to this, but might be a relationship without compensation and still have the control for factual reasons. And I think that's a difficult question we're going to have to answer. But
you said the I want to pose another hypothetical to you. You put the very interesting the chief judge's question alluded to the hypothetical of you ask somebody to shoot a fox for you, and the government says that's more or less a favor and the rest of it. And I wonder, you know, if we say that compensation is necessary, whether we are restricting the intent of Congress in all kinds of situations. And one that occurs to me is, what about an intern? You know, we have interns in our office, some during the summer. I mean, they're interns all over Congress and the executive branch. None of these interns are compensated in any way. They're not paid. And yet they would certainly be thought, I would think, to be within the language of this statute. In other words, there's a danger here, I think, of making a restrictive interpretation where there are all kinds of relationships that people would think of as employment relationships that are non-compensated today. People take jobs without pay. And during the recession, I mean, during the Great Depression, people took jobs without pay in the hope of proving their worth so that they one day would get paid. But when you think about the intern situation and many, many others, it can't be that the payment of a regular salary or wages is a sine qua non in the statute, can you?
I don't want to extend this. Your hypothetical, Justice Connor tells the story that she served as a prosecutor without pay in order to prove her worth and to get the job. Do you remember?
Yes. Well, she did. That was her first job.
Well, what we need to do is we need to dial up Justice O'Connor and ask her whether she was employed. Maybe that will resolve the whole matter for her.
Thank you.
That's pretty. Hello, you have some time remaining.
Just a couple brief points. We are asking for a limited opinion that reverses the district court on the very narrow issue of what it means to be employed, and that it does not mean
you still have a considerable burden at trial.
No doubt, and we're happy to go to trial on facts that allow us to put on evidence regarding the control that the gang leader has over his underlings.
Mr. Purdy basically says he had a permit, he carried a gun before, and he just happened to attend a meeting. That may create a burden for you.
That's exactly right, and those are facts that we're ready to deal with at trial. But what's interesting about that is if the defendant and Mr. Weaver, Mr. Purdy's client, is not prohibited, so he can have a permit, he can carry a gun wherever, whenever he wants. No problem under Heller, protect hearth and home, carry it wherever it's legal, but he can't carry it to be the armed bodyguard of a convicted felon. And that's where the course of employment comes in, because we need to prove, and we would if we could get to trial on this issue without compensation, that he was doing it because the boss ordered him to, because, you know, being the leader of an outlaw motorcycle gang is pretty dangerous, and he ordered his people to carry guns to protect them. And that's, but again, those are the facts. If I can...
But those are facts we don't have to accept and should not accept.
Exactly.
We can hypothesize them.
And strict statutory interpretation, employed does not mean exclusively payment of compensation. And
I assume I'm right. Give me the definition I'm to use that would include your theory of the case, but exclude the guy shooting the rabbit fox.
That's where the agency terms come in, where employ can mean multiple things: to engage the services of, payment of wages, and under the agency principles, that the employer or the principal must exercise control over the employee, the agent.
In what regard?
It's a factual determination for the jury.
I don't think agency's enough. I think the agency, the killing the fox, might be an agency relationship, but maybe. But
there's no control. The person doesn't have to sit out. You kill your own fox.
Exactly. There has to be control over the activities of the employee.
And that's where it's more like a master-servant relationship.
Well, it is. It's a master-servant and employee-employer about the same thing, isn't it, for purposes of legal discussion?
Sure, but is the neighbor who says, yeah, I'll do you a favor, is the convicted felon neighbor the master?
No, I'm going along with you, but I'm saying you're describing it more as an agency, and I'm not sure an agent is sufficient. I may be wrong, but I do know that the master-servant requires control. And the Supreme Court said that, and so does the restatement say that.
And we're happy with that limitation.
All of the activities for which are being scrutinized. So here, the shooting of the fox would have to be in control of the master.
Right.
And the evidence, the hypothetical, isn't sufficient to indicate one way or the other on that.
Exactly. Judge Traxler, I would point you to page 634 of the joint appendix, where the district court cites a number of cases that give him the authority to dismiss the case when the United States concedes that under the ruling that the court has made that we can't make the case, and the only circuit court case is a Tenth Circuit case, and the site is 20 F3rd 1084, and the case is Hall. If there are no other questions, the United States respectfully requests the court to reverse the district court's opinion dismissing an order, dismissing our charges under 922H. Employed does not only mean compensated. Thank you.
Purdy, I noticed that you're court appointed. We appreciate very much your undertaking the representation of this client.
Thank you.
We'll come down and